And as well, there's a board certification process with infectious disease as well.
Yes, it's a subspecialty board. And with it's within infectious disease, there's been talk for some time about having a subspecialty within the specialty for HIV care. That is not currently a separate board, but it's been talked about extensively for a number of years now.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. This is very useful information. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio, and the number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502. Faye, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters.
It's a pleasure. Thank
you. And in terms of what you see as an educator, what do you see is the role of the educator in hospital infection control?
Dr. Brewer, before I answer your question, I would like to clarify something regarding the title of infection preventionist. In year 2002, Association for Practitioners of Infection Prevention and Control decided to change the title of infection control practitioners to infection preventionist. And the reason was, they said, we are really trying to aim at reducing or preventing infections rather than letting them loose and then chasing them. So that's what we're doing. We're actually trying to prevent the spread of these infections rather than controlling them. And I think this should be our policy regarding whatever we do. We go with preventive measures that are less costly, less troublesome, rather than creating them and then treating them.
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Absolutely. I believe that.
We have our first caller, and let's go ahead and take that, and then we'll get right back to what you're telling us about infection prevention. We have Dave from Shreveport. Dave, thank you so much for calling tonight.
You're welcome. And I have kind of a two-part question. My wife and I get flu shots every year. My wife is in the healthcare industry, and she is highly encouraged to get one to prevent her giving the flu to somebody else. Last year, she got what I think was called an arthritic rage as a result of the flu shot that ate up the cartilage in her hip joint. She's had to have her hip replacement. In talking to another gentleman that we go to church with, he said that after his flu shot a couple of years ago, he went deaf in one ear and lost part of his vocal cords, which he attributes to the flu shot as well. I continue to get the flu shot, as does my wife, and we just kind of keep our fingers crossed. But are these, I know they're not common because lots of people get the flu shot. Not everybody comes down with these kinds of maladies, but could you address that?
Absolutely, Dave. Thank you so much for calling.
I'll hang up and listen if you don't mind.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Dr. Negron, the flu shot is safe. We know it's a safe vaccination, but can you talk a little bit about maybe what Dave could mean by arthritic rage following the shot?
Actually, I'm not sure because I've never actually encountered that as a side effect. To put it in context, this year there's about 120 million doses of flu shots which have been distributed. Most adults and children are going to be vaccinated. There is a small percentage of side effects and an occasional severe side effect. But for decades, we've had the influenza vaccines available, and for the most part, they are efficacious, meaning they work, and they're safe. Now, does that mean that nobody ever gets an occasional reaction beyond maybe an achy arm or a little bit of fever or they feel run down for a few days? No, it's documented, but it's exceedingly rare. I've never actually had an individual develop a failed joint as a side effect of this. So that's I'm not familiar with that at all.
In terms of, we were talking before the show started, are there special populations that may need to take precautions in terms of the immune reaction to the vaccination? Maybe someone who has an immunocompromised state, you know, or rheumatoid arthritis, or they're or getting cancer chemotherapy or medication for psoriasis, things along those lines.
Well, on that topic, and we're talking only about the injectable influenza vaccine. We're not going to even mention the intranasal. That's completely different. But just the injectable, the flu shot, quote unquote, that is a killed vaccine. The virus used for it is deceased. It is physically incapable of reproducing, and it is safe whether you are, quote, a normal host, unquote, or an immunocompromised host, a cancer patient, an AIDS patient, somebody taking immunosuppressing medicines for their rheumatologic or Crohn's disease, for instance. So the virus is safe in the vaccine because it cannot reproduce.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and the topic is infectious diseases. The number for your call or question, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Joining us tonight, Dr. Gerardo Negron with Shreveport Infectious Disease, as well as Faye Mafakri, an educator with the Willis-Knighton Health System who has worked in infection prevention for hospitals.
Dr. Brewer, I have a personal experience with the question that the caller had. Every year at Willis-Knighton, we vaccinate several thousand employees, and this year, so far, we have had more than 3,000 who have been vaccinated. All these years, I have never had anyone with any side effects the way this caller explained. This year we had one nurse who actually developed some muscle weakness 24 hours after vaccination, and he sought medical attention, and they told her, they told him that this was actually because of the vaccine, but he recuperated completely and he's back to work. So it was just and they told him, don't get another flu shot. It was, they told him once in 2 million that can happen to a patient as a result of vaccination. So it's as Dr. Negron mentioned, it's extremely rare to have these side effects.
Now, you were speaking a little bit to us about infection prevention in the hospital and what your role was in that capacity. Tell us a little bit more about that in terms of infection prevention in the hospital and how you go about educating hospital employees to not spread infections.
Right. Infection preventionists need to have great rapport with other departments. For instance, let's say a lab. Those are the ones who actually inform us regarding the significant microbiological cultures, or doctor's offices. Sometimes a patient goes through a surgical procedure and they develop a site infection. They don't necessarily come to the hospital for debridement, but they go to the doctor's offices for, let's say, antibiotic therapy. And if we have good rapport with them, relationship, they're going to let us know, which in turn we have to report it to the regulatory agencies. And also, collecting and analyzing of infectious data is very important. Case finding, sometimes finding the index case regarding these infections, especially in long-term care facilities, patients being there for months, is very crucial to find the person who is actually carrier of a disease or is infected with it.
Very good information. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and you're listening to Health Matters, a live show. Our topic tonight is infectious disease. The number for your calls, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Negron, we started with talking about the flu. We talked about side effects of the flu vaccine, actually, but let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit about what the flu is. We know it's a virus, but expand upon that a little bit, if you will.
Well, the influenza virus comes actually in several types. Most of what you see in people are either influenza A, which is mostly what we get during the winter months, early November till maybe beginning of April, and to a lesser extent, influenza B. And when you hear about influenza viruses being categorized with numbers and letters, it refers to two different viral products. So we classify the influenza A's, and there's an H and an N, and there's numbers, and there's different types, and they tend to vary a little bit from year to year to year, which is the reason we end up getting a new influenza vaccination every single year, because the virus constantly is changing. And on rare occasion, fortunately, every few decades, it changes quite a bit. When that happens, though, that's when you do have a pandemic. Of course, 1918-1919 was a famous pandemic. About 5 to 6 years ago, we had another pandemic. So it occurs every couple of decades. And influenza is not unique to humans. There's influenza viruses for most animal species. And for the most part, animal viruses tend not to infect and then spread among people. But on rare occasion, people have heard of bird flu and outbreaks in China and Vietnam and having to kill whole bird populations like chickens. On occasion, you do get them into humans. So, and then the fear is, well, they start to spread through the human population. To date, for the most part, that doesn't happen.
Faye, from the standpoint of hospitals, how are hospitals informed about flu activities in their region?
Very good question. Every week, infection preventionists at each hospital, they're required to report the number of patients who were admitted to the hospital or came to the emergency room with suspected signs and symptoms of flu. They're required to report it to the Office of Public Health in New Orleans. And in turn, they generate a report which is statewide, and they send it to all these hospitals regarding the activity and the prevalence of flu in that region. So we are actually required to report these infections to the state health.
Dr. Negron, is the flu a clinical diagnosis, or is there a laboratory test that a physician can perform to make the diagnosis?
The presentation is a clinical evaluation, and then you confirm with several different tests. So typically, starting at the winter through early spring, fever, so temperatures over 100 degrees, intense muscle aches, weakness, coughing are common symptoms. Those can be confused with regular cold viruses. But if it is that severe and you visit your primary care doctor or urgent care facility, they can test for influenza. We used to do antigen-based tests, but those have been replaced to some degree by a different methodology called PCR. Those can be confirmatory, but there is a certain false negative with the older tests, so that's why the clinical symptoms are the first way to address the case, and is it suspicious for influenza, and is it the right time of year, and is there influenza in the community already?
So is it the right time of year, and so we're getting word now that the flu shot is available, so I'm making the assumption that it's the right time of year now. The flu is,
yes,
is actually out there right now.
By early November, typically, is when it starts. It varies a little in terms of earlier or later, but pretty much by November 1st, we should expect somewhere in the country. Individual communities will vary, though. But somewhere in the country, we'll start to see influenza.
Do we know yet how it's played out in the U.S. in terms of the flu this year, if it started, and where has it started?
Actually, I've not seen reports of influenza cases yet. But again, we're not quite into the season yet, and we've been unusually warm, so we're not really into the colder weather just yet in most of the country either.
And so does the flu season, if you will, does it vary depending on the length of the temperature decreases or the length of winter?
Well, since it typically goes November to April, pretty much it corresponds to the colder weather. And when we're in winter and the southern hemisphere is in summer, they don't have flu. When it reverses, they get the flu and we get the summer. But when we try to predict next year's vaccination, we make these decisions right at the beginning of this coming year, we will basically use what was present in the southern hemisphere and what's present currently in the northern hemisphere to predict what 3 to 4 types of virus should we include for the next vaccine.
Okay, very good. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and our show tonight is a live one. It's Health Matters, and the topic is infectious diseases. The number for your calls or comments, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Our guest tonight, we have Dr. Gerardo Negron with Shreveport Infectious Diseases, as well as Faye Mifakri, an educator regarding infection prevention in our hospital systems.
Thank you.
Faye, whenever we talk about flu prevention, obviously the flu shot is really, really very important. But let's say, for example, the gentleman or person that you mentioned earlier, it was recommended that they not get another flu shot because of a reaction. How can one prevent getting the flu if they can't get a flu shot for some reason?
At Willis-Knighton, we start vaccinating our patients as of September 1st, and we go all the way through March 31st. For our employees, usually the second week of October, and we highly recommend everybody to get their flu shots unless they're allergics, they have severe allergic reaction to eggs, or if they have shown a previous bad reaction to the flu shot. But if someone, for some reason, cannot get the flu shot, we tell them, hey, wash your hands as often as long as you can, because that's where the problem is. You touch a surface that is contaminated with the virus. We tell them avoid crowds. Try to boost your immune system by eating well, exercising, maybe resting, sleeping well. These are all the factors that boost your immune and help fight the infection. And I tell people during the cold and flu season, avoid shaking hands with people. Go with fisting bump, bumping fist, and that would be better option rather than, because it's less surface and less contact time, so go with that rather than the whole handshake.
Along those same lines, we've had a question that was submitted in. Are there other components in the flu vaccine besides the flu antigens that people can be allergic to?
Dr. Negron, maybe
there's a number of chemical components, and the reason we keep mentioning eggs is, except for one form of flu vaccine, except for one name brand product, everything else is literally grown in chicken eggs to produce the virus. So there's always going to be a small amount of protein from the chicken eggs that go through the purification process. But like with most medications and other vaccinations, there are preservatives, there are other chemical compounds, but these are generally seeing the same thing that we've used in vaccinations for years, whether it was childhood vaccines when we were children, maybe 40 or 50 years ago, or vaccines now.
Okay, we had another question about the flu vaccine that was submitted. Is there anyone in particular who should be excluded from getting a flu shot? And is it safe for pregnant women?
Yes, it is very safe for pregnant women. As a matter of fact, that's the population that needs to get vaccinated first. Because of pregnancy, there is a higher volume of blood which put pressure on lungs and heart and also immune system in a woman. And they can benefit from the flu shot. If they get the flu, it's going to be very severe. And there's a possibility of premature labor and even delivery. And these babies are going to be protected after they're born. Within 6 months, depending on when the mother got the flu shot. So it is beneficial both to the mother and the newborn baby.
Very good information. In terms of challenges, are there any challenges regarding the flu vaccination in general that you see as a hospital preventionist?
It is so unfortunate that with all the education that is provided, there are still people who think they're going to get the flu from flu shot. As Dr. Negron mentioned this, the flu injectable one is dead virus, and it just gives you the immunity. It does not give you the flu. But there are people who are adamant about, I got the flu shot and I ended up with the flu. People don't realize that it takes 2 weeks to develop antibody. And it's possible that during those 2 weeks, you get exposed to the flu virus and you end up with the flu.
You know, that brings up a good question. Dr. Negron, is there any such thing as post-exposure prophylaxis for the flu? Let's say you come into contact with someone that you know.
for
has the flu or you know, high clinical suspicion, and you haven't gotten your flu shot, or at least it's maybe it hasn't been 2 weeks.
For certain populations, cancer patients, transplant patients, it does exist. Some of the same medications which are used to treat influenza, a group called neuraminidase inhibitors, there's two of them, can be used, and in particular some populations that can't receive the vaccination. But this is a very, very small population. But on the topic of people claiming to get flu, even though they received the vaccine or because they received the vaccine, just to clarify something, the primary reason to vaccinate for influenza isn't necessarily that it's going to prevent you from getting the flu. It may. If you're under 50, it is very effective at preventing you from getting the flu if you encounter the virus. As you get older, 50 to 60, 60 to 70, 80, we have 9-year-olds, the efficacy of preventing influenza infection in that group starts to go down. But the primary reason to give it to everybody, even though elderly, where it will not, may not prevent the flu, is it will prevent you from dying if you get the flu. So preventing death from influenza is the primary benefit of the flu vaccine. So even last year's flu vaccine, which was not a good match for the viruses floating around, you still had a degree of protection, and that the mortality was not higher than typical years, which is 40 to 50,000 deaths in this country from flu every single year, and about 500,000 people worldwide die from flu every single year. The mortality was not higher last year despite not a good match, because it still worked to prevent you from dying, which is obviously the most serious consequence of getting influenza.
So it decreases disease severity in,
yes,
in cases in which the flu is contracted anyway.
Back to your question, Dr. Brewer, you asked who does not qualify to get the vaccine. If an employee is actively infected with fever, we do not vaccinate them. We wait till they are recuperated, then we do the vaccination, because their immune system is already bombarded with the infection and we don't want to overwhelm it any further, and they're not going to develop good antibody.
Okay, very good. Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is infectious diseases. We've been talking a lot about the flu, so if you haven't gotten your flu shot, I would recommend that you go ahead and do so. The number here for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We had a few more questions that were submitted in online. Dr. Negron, I know we haven't talked about this yet, but the questioner is asking, what is the chikungunya virus? And can you tell us if there's any risk for contracting that virus in our region?
Chikungunya virus is something you typically see in tropical areas, but it has been moving further and further north, and it is characterized by severe myalgias, muscle pains like you got hit by a car, and fever and just viral type symptoms. It actually has moved into the continental U.S. Typically, people have got it from travel, but you are seeing an occasional case that is transmitted, say, southwest Texas along the Mexican border, extreme south Florida. Cases are moving into the U.S. I forget which family it belongs to, but it's another arthropod, an insect-borne disease.
So it's
disease.
Another mosquito-borne virus,
yeah,
just like
basically.
Ebola, or not Ebola, but malaria.
Well, not malaria, but West Nile.
Like West Nile.
West
right,
Nile virus.
Right. Another question that was submitted in regarding viral diseases would be, when should the shingles vaccine be given? How effective is it? And how long should someone wait after they've gotten the shingles outbreak before they go ahead and get the shingles vaccine?
Well, the first part of that, who should get it, when do you get it? The actual FDA approval is for everybody age 60 and above. And because vaccination for children for chickenpox didn't start until the late 90s, 80 to 90% of the adults prior to the late 90s pretty much can be sure they got chickenpox. which means as they get older, over age 50, over age 60, they are at risk to have a reactivation of the virus, which is what we call shingles. Same virus, different name. So over age 60, candidates to get these, what's called the zoster vaccine. Some professional societies would lower that age to age 50. That virus is what's called live attenuated. It's not dead, like say the influenza shot. So there will be a warning about people who have immune compromised states, advanced AIDS, cancer patients, organ transplant patients. Some people are not a candidate for it. But in general, many people are, and it actually works very well to prevent outbreaks of the shingles. If you happen to have developed shingles and your doctor diagnoses you, you can still receive the vaccine, but because you likely will receive treatment, you do want to wait a good 2 weeks at least after you finished any treatment for the shingles to be vaccinated.
Let's go ahead and take our next caller. We have Bonnie from Bunky. Bonnie, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi. I have a question, and it's been on my mind for almost 30 years. My son had Guillain-Barré, and I know he's not supposed to take the flu shot, and our family never did really take flu shots when we were young, but I started when he was born because I didn't want him to get the flu. Why is it that he can't have this?
Bonnie, thank you so much. That's a great question. Dr. Negron, before you answer, Bonnie, let me ask you, was his Guillain-Barré following a viral infection, or was it following a vaccination? Was there any identified precursor?
Because that's supposedly the way you get it. He had had strep throat the week before, so he could have had some type of virus. His fever had spiked to 104, and he had confirmed strep throat. And then within 5 days of that confirmation, he was almost completely paralyzed,
And if I can ask, how's the recovery been from that?
He's fine. He played football in high school, and he still has some things that we might kind of, attribute to that, but we really never did follow up too much with it. I just know that every time he gets any type of viral infection, I panic.
Right.
And
right.
I know when he went to college, he couldn't take the meningitis vaccine also. I mean, there's several things that he's limited with because of the history of Guillain-Barré. And so I thought, well, hey, if I have this infection control, God, this is the time to ask.
Yeah, great question. Thank you so much for calling us tonight. Dr. Negron, what can you tell Bonnie about Guillain-Barré and not getting a flu shot after that?
Now, first of all, if you read the contraindications for the influenza shot, it's actually, that's an illness that's listed in there, so they're going to say, no, you can't have it if you've had this before. But that particular illness, nobody actually knows what causes it. It does happen sporadically. It's never been proven to be caused by any particular vaccine. However, you will see reports here and there. But the rates have never gone up for that illness in terms of diagnosis because of vaccines, which are used by the millions. In terms of, did we have a viral pharyngitis or an actual proven, because there's only two ways to confirm a quote, strep throat, unquote. Either you culture it or you do a rapid test, both of which would have been around 30 years ago. But if we didn't do either and prove that we have a particular kind of strep bacteria called group A, we don't know for sure. If we ended up having a viral pharyngitis, which will act the same way and give you big swollen, red, nasty-looking tonsils and a sore throat and big glands, that could have been a viral infection and we could have gotten it from that. So there's no way to know for sure. But if you look at the fine print on the package insert, or from a pharmacist, if you look at the info they give you when you get these vaccines, you will see certain things that they ask you about, and Guillain-Barré syndrome and a few other things, egg allergies, are there. And if you check these off, they're gonna tell you, no, you can't have it.
Do you know of any cases of repeated Guillain-Barré or reemergence of Guillain-Barré symptoms after vaccination in someone who has previously had a post-viral case?
Actually, I don't.
I don't either. And I mean, I'm a neurologist, and it would be something that I would presumably have heard about. But I think it's probably as much of a liability for the companies that produce the vaccine, as well as, since we don't know why some individuals get Guillain-Barré after a simple viral infection and some individuals don't. If he's otherwise healthy, I would follow the instructions on the package insert.
Right. Well, I am a pharmacist, and I know it's there, you know, and I've looked at it, and I worry a lot. But, you know, like I said, one time his dad took him without thinking about it and got one, and I prayed all that, you know, that he wouldn't get it. But since it's not a live virus, you know, I never did understand, you know, why. But I'm not going to take that chance.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the precedent for that may be as much on the legal level as it is on the scientific level. But thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Thank you for your answer. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go ahead and go to Charles from Shreveport. Charles, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, well, thank you. I was listening a minute ago, and I heard y'all talking about people, well, you know, in their older years, 50s, 60s, and talking about the shingles virus and stuff. I have an autoimmune deficiency, and so therefore when I get sick really quick. And that was something I just found out within the last 2 or 3 years. Everybody would look at me and say, it just doesn't make sense, you know. So I'm 60, and because I have this, how does that affect me with the shingles vaccine?
Charles, can you be a little bit more specific in terms of what sort of immune problem that you have?
I think they called it IgA.
IgA deficiency?
Yeah.
Okay. And has your doctor instructed you not to get the flu shot because of your IgA deficiency?
No, I haven't thought to ask them yet.
Okay. Dr. Negron, would you have any thoughts about IgA deficiency and the flu vaccine?
Well, immunoglobulins, which are antibodies, which includes IgA and a couple other types, those generally are not going to be although technically they are an immune deficiency, those generally are not going to be contradictory to getting a flu vaccine. There are several other types which involve the other branch of the immune system called cell-mediated immunity, and advanced AIDS being an easy example.
But
you can't get it. Oh, I'm sorry, could you come again?
I'm concerned about the flu as the shingles. Shingles virus. How would that affect me with shingles?
But because the shingles, which is the chickenpox virus, the shingles vaccine is a live attenuated, not a dead virus like the injectable flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
It is contraindicated in very specific diagnoses, which are actually listed on the product. So you can go through the details, and it will list if you have this illness, that illness, that illness. No, you should not have it because the virus in there is alive, it's fixed, so supposedly not to reproduce, but alive.
Right, okay. All right, well, that's just something I've been thinking about, and like I said, I had the radio on and heard y'all, so I thought, well, maybe I'll call real quick and see what you can tell me.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yes, Charles, thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Thank you, bye.
Another caller is asking, Faye, why is the influenza virus more prevalent in cold months?
It's a very good question, because usually during the cold months we are all staying indoors and there is not much ventilation, and necessarily flu does not populate more in the cold season, but since people are near each other and some might be infected, that's how it gets around. It's not because there are too many flu viruses in cold season.
Okay, Dr. Negron, another questioner is asking, how long, if you do get the flu, does it take to get over it? And how do you treat the flu if you miss your opportunity to get vaccinated and you actually contact it and get sick?
Now, if you don't get vaccinated, and you don't get treated, and I'll mention treatment in just a moment, you likely are going to be feeling sick for a good 1 to 2 weeks, and at least while you are still feverish, so temps over 100 degrees, you are still infectious. And that usually will go on for a good week or so. But you're going to be feeling pretty bad for a good week, maybe two. If you are diagnosed with the flu, influenza, and you visit your doctor, he or she can start you on one of two what they call neuraminidase inhibitors, which are the treatment. Those are the preferred treatments. One is an inhaled substance. The other one is oral medicine. If you are diagnosed and start this within 48 hours, it will decrease the symptom duration by several days. But if it's diagnosed beyond that initial time period, there's really no benefit outside of severe cases, which I'm not going to get too much into. But outside of severe cases, there's really not much benefit to using the neuraminidase inhibitors, either of the two, beyond about the first 48 hours, definitely beyond 72 hours. So you got to get diagnosed quickly.
Okay, very good. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. And the number for our callers to call for questions, it's 1-800-552-8502. Or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. And the questions have been coming in. Dr. Negron, one question a healthcare provider is actually asking. They're saying they have an HIV-positive patient, and this individual says he's not interested in treatment. He's been positive for HIV for 10 years without any evidence of AIDS, and knows that apparently he's a Native American, and knows that other Native Americans rapidly declined after HIV therapy was initiated. Is there any scientific research to back up perhaps a claim that Native Americans may rapidly decompensate and develop AIDS after they're treated with HIV therapy? I mean, this is something I'm not aware of. Is this something that you're aware of?
The answer to that is very easily no. Now, an individual, and especially males more than females, for not entirely understood reasons, can go along for a good 10 years easily and not be symptomatic. They may have manifestations at the laboratory level, but they may feel fine. They may not look ill. That would not be unusual. But once therapy is started, and therapy now is distinctly different than prior to 1996. Anybody who got one or two drug therapy from 87 through 1995, therapy was going to fail because everything was the same class and it didn't work for very long. Post-1996, where different classes of medicine became available to use in combination, that therapy, which used to have more side effects in the late 90s, much more tolerable now, if taken, will actually keep you healthy. You will not advance to AIDS, and if you've already advanced into the AIDS category, which there are a number of criteria to meet that diagnosis, it will keep you healthy and will regenerate your immune system by several surrogate markers that your doctor can use. So the exact opposite happens if you take therapy. You will stay healthy.
Okay, very good. Let's go ahead and take our next caller. We have Robert from Shreveport. Robert, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Doing well. How can we help you out with an infectious disease?
I have one question. Do antibodies help prevent flu? Because I received a heavy dose of it when I was in the hospital last week for surgery. And my question was, does it help prevent the flu? Or you have to have the flu shot, you know, totally?
Robert, thank you so much. That's a good question. Faye, Robert was in the hospital. He said he got antibiotics while he was in the hospital. And will that prevent him from getting the flu?
No, antibiotics do not work on viruses at all.
So it sounds like if otherwise appropriate, he would need to go ahead and get a flu shot to get the maximum prevention for the flu.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Okay, I'll have to talk to my doctor because, like I say, I just came out of being a cancer patient. I just came out of surgery, so I had to speak with him, and I guess I can take it from there.
Yeah, definitely discuss it with your doctor and make sure that your other treatments and other medical information is given to them, and you can come up with the right decision in terms of whether it's getting the flu shot or being very careful with your potential exposures during the flu season.
Okay, great. That was my question, and thank you much.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for calling us tonight.
All righty now. Okay.
Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer. The topic tonight is infectious diseases. We're talking about the flu, HIV, and other infectious causes of maladies. The number for your questions or calls, 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight, Dr. Gerardo Negron with Shreveport Infectious Disease, as well as Faye Mifakri. She is an infectious disease specialist in infection prevention, especially in hospitals. Dr. Negron, we had a really good question about HIV, and let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about HIV and what the updates are. You did mention that drug therapy has advanced quite markedly over the past couple of decades, and what more can you tell us about what's on the horizon for HIV, and what can folks in our region do to help out these folks?
Well, on the topic of HIV, remember the epidemic is 3.5 decades old now. We recognized it in hindsight and officially named it about 1980-1981. As I had mentioned, therapy initially, starting in 87 with the very first drug called Zidovudine, or AZT, up through about 1995, was not very effective. There were several medicines. They all worked exactly the same, and therapy would wear out quickly. Post-1996, the therapeutic regimens, which will treat, not cure, but treat HIV, are effective, long-term effective, and much better tolerated. Very few pills, sometimes just one pill a day, and can keep you healthy so that you can potentially live to the average of about mid-70s, which is normal for men and women in this country. Now, one cannot tell that one has HIV or HIV/AIDS just by looking at somebody. You have to have a test. It might be a rapid test on secretions from the mouth, or it could be a blood-based test, but you have to be tested. You can be positive and have no symptoms. You can be positive and start to show certain lab abnormalities, so you're starting to get sick. Or you can be positive and you can have AIDS, which is advanced disease. Only your doctor can test you. Only your doctor, if you are positive, can tell you where you stand. As of April of this year, national guidelines for therapy are that every single HIV positive individual, whether they have advanced disease or have no symptoms or and lab abnormalities other than the positive test, current recommendations, everybody should be on treatment at this time. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Everybody should be offered treatment. Partly because we know that if people are treated early, they are getting a better response. And secondly, of the 1.1 to 1.2 million people living with the disease in this country, so that's about a million out of 315 million, it's fairly common, about 20% of people who are expected to be positive out of that 1.1 million don't know their diagnosis. But that group, which is about 200,000 people, maybe 250,000 people, makes up more than half of the transmission of all new cases.
Let's get back to our callers, and then before we finish tonight, I want to go through some of the risk factors for HIV and for those folks out there who need to learn about those and whether they or their loved ones may need to be tested. Philip from Lufkin.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. What's your question?
Yes, sir. I have a question just basically about the flu shot. I've never had one, and at this point don't ever intend to get one. I'm hardly ever sick, and I don't know if I've ever actually had the flu. Try to convince me otherwise if you think I should.
All right. Well, I think that should be fairly simple and straightforward. Faye, you've given a lot of flu shots in your lifetime. Tell Philip why he should get one.
Well, Philip, lots of time I ask people, have you had your flu shot? They said, no, I never get the flu. I say, okay. Did you ever have a head-on collision in your car? No, I never had it. But we all fasten our seatbelt. It's a preventive measure. And you have to realize that, as Dr. Negron mentioned, the idea of flu shot is not for protecting the individual. We call it herd immunity. If more people are vaccinated, we are going to have less virus getting around. And that is the idea of flu shot. We are trying to prevent an epidemic. And if you're a healthcare worker, it is going to be selfish if you do not take your flu shot, because you might end up with a very mild case of flu, no fever, no coughing, just a little runny nose, and pass that virus to a patient who's immunosuppressed and kill them. And it happens.
So it's not just for us individuals, exactly. It's for our loved ones and anyone that we're exposed to as well.
Correct.
That sounds like a really good reason. Marcia from Benton. Marcia, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, I have a question as to why is there a West Nile vaccine for horses but not for humans?
All right, that's a good question. Dr. Negron, West Nile vaccination in humans, where are we with that?
Actually, there's not a lot of active investigation there. There are some areas, especially early in the century when West Nile moved into the country. The reason it exists for horses is because it works there. The version for humans, and we had some development in the Middle East, like about Israel, it never really worked well. They did have what's called a passive immunization with antibodies, immunoglobulins, which were effective at preventing severe illness, but you cannot harvest enough of this out of positive donors, people who had the virus who are well now. And at this point, since West Nile is now endemic, meaning it's naturally found pretty much in the entire lower 48, and cases are now sporadic versus 14 or 15 years ago when it was epidemic, it's like many of its related viruses that cause encephalitis or brain infections and various other things, they're pretty much here to stay, and it's just sporadic cases.
It'd be very difficult to eliminate it by
herd immunity. Yeah, it's here to stay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have Doyle from East Texas. Doyle, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Greetings. I think I've got a question. It's a kind of a follow-up from my wife had caught a quina after a cortisone injection in her back at Christmas time in 2011, and ended up spending almost 3 months in the hospital undergoing IV antibiotic therapy. And she's fully recovered, but what are the long-term, in other words, she's experienced some weight gain, she's got some toe problems, and pain in her feet and things like that. Would that be, a status post condition of that, or I can't find anything, doing all kinds of research on my own.
Sure, Doyle. When you mentioned cauda equina, and that's actually the horse's tail is actually what it means. It's the shape of the nerves as they leave the spine to go into the pelvis and the lower extremities. And you said she developed that after an injection. My question is, was there a proven infection, or was this something that happened and was not associated with meningitis or an abscess in the back?
Well, we're not sure. She had a cortisone injection in her for back problem, and like 8 days later, I had to call an ambulance because she became bowel incontinent, and she couldn't urinate, and she lost use of her legs. And she was only 52 at the time, and they got her there, and the doctor drove down from Nacogdoches to Lufkin. He said, she wouldn't survive a helicopter trip getting her from Lufkin to Nacogdoches. And so he drove and got on her. That's what they called it. And I was just wondering if her intracranial pressure, ICP, I've learned all these terms, went up, and that caused further problems. But we had great doctors. If it had been 3 hours later, she wouldn't have made it.
So you mentioned intracranial pressure after a back injection, so I'm thinking that perhaps meningitis developed?
We never heard meningitis.
Okay.
That wasn't the term used, and I'm just really curious as to the after effects, because they cut her. She's got about a 3-inch long incision on her spine.
Okay, so maybe they took out an epidural abscess. Did they mention that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much. That clarifies it somewhat. Dr. Negron Doyle's asking about after an epidural abscess, what would her risk be going forward?
Now, on the top of getting these procedures, which, you know, you're familiar with these things, any small procedure, even if it doesn't have to be a large surgery, it can be an injection. And from time to time, we will get an infectious complication. And if you're injecting the spine, it's still a surgical procedure. Might be small, but it's still a procedure. And from time to time, you will get localized infections in the bones, the disc, or you will form an abscess. And if that should happen, which is uncommon, but it's happened, these abscesses in an enclosed area such as that will quickly squish, literally compress or squish if you prefer, the spinal cord, and it will become non-functional. If they gave a prolonged therapy with some antibiotic medicines, had a surgical intervention to evacuate and alleviate the pressure by evacuating the abscess, it will not come back unless we have further injections. But the damage done, either from the surgery, the infection, or both, we'll have long-term residual sequelae, you know, leftover side effects. May not be as functional before, afterwards as before. You may have chronic pain. The scarring may cause nerve compression to some degree, where you may have numbness. If it's been several years, as he mentions, at this point, the current level of function and leftover symptoms is pretty much what you would expect to last lifelong.
Doyle, thank you so much for your question. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and the show tonight is Health Matters, and we are talking about infectious diseases. We've had a number of excellent questions tonight. Dr. Negron, you were talking about HIV, and we didn't wrap up that topic, and I'd like you to have the chance to go ahead and finish that before we move on to some of the other questions that we have.
Well, just on the topic of HIV, because this is an important topic to the state of Louisiana, I want to read some quote some data from about between 2009 and 2011. This puts HIV in Louisiana in context to the country. So 2009, national HIV risk, about 17 cases for every 100,000 people, and AIDS, which is more advanced disease, about 11 cases for every 100,000 people. In 2011, this is Louisiana now, our HIV rate, as opposed to 17 per 100,000 national, was 36.5 per 100,000 people. That's on par with the rate of California, Texas, Florida, New York State, you know, very large states. Our AIDS cases, which are advanced disease, 19.5 per 100,000 people. That's on par with Florida, Texas, California, New Jersey, New York, Georgia, they have a lot of cases. So we have an epidemic of HIV, which is quietly ongoing. It's been ongoing for the 80s, the 90s. It improved for a while. It's back with, and it has not gone away. On that topic, because the current recommendation is every single adult or teenager, mid-teens, all the way up to adults, about 64 or 65, should receive an HIV test at least once in their lifetime. We do not care about risk factors. Everybody gets at least a baseline test, just like testing for high cholesterol, elevated blood sugar, checking you for high blood pressure when you go to the doctor's office. Everybody should be tested. That's been a recommendation for several years. We are lagging behind. It's been a recommendation 5 or 6 years now. Within the state of Louisiana, even if you do not have health insurance, which is a large segment of the population, there are a number of places you can go and get tested. For instance, you can get tested at the health unit, which is the health department. The Martin Luther King Free Care Clinic, where I run a free AIDS clinic once a month, they can test. The local AIDS advocacy organization, the Philadelphia Center, they offer testing. They offer a free care clinic with Dr. Vela's staff slot clinic once or twice a month. They offer free STD as well as HIV testing and can refer. So there are a number of places where people can go to get tested if you don't know your status, at least once in a lifetime. And then additional testing based on what your risk factors are. And make no bones about it, HIV is a equal opportunity illness. Gay, straight, or in between, everybody is affected, male and female.
There's a questioner who's been asking, speaking of viral testing, a new test called ViroCap. When will that be available? Do you know anything about that test?
Actually, I'm not familiar with that particular test.
What about the over-the-counter HIV test? Is that available in our region?
Yes, they are. There are a number of tests you can do, at-home tests. Most of them involve scraping cells from the inside of the cheek. They can be mailed in. They are reliable. There are also a number of rapid tests that can be done at a doctor's office or an outpatient clinic. And some of the older tests, which are more confirmatory blood-based tests, have actually improved. We're into what's called the fourth generation of HIV blood test, where the what's called the window period, or the time where you can be positive but we can't detect it yet, is now shortened to about 2 to 3 weeks, where it used to be 3 to 4 weeks or longer than that. So the tests are much more reliable. They can be done with over-the-counter mail-in tests.
All right, very good. I'd like to thank Dr. Negron as well as Faye Mifakri for joining us tonight, and thank all of our callers for calling us tonight for Health Matters on Red River Radio. As you know, Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio, and you should consult your physician or healthcare provider for all health concerns. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated or selected based on relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for their participation in Health Matters. This show is available from redriverradio.org for download. The producer of Health Matters is Ms. Renee Moran. Assistance tonight has been provided by Wally Derleth. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. It'll be the mental health edition, and the topic will be psychopathy. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.